You might be wondering about Max. He's the one with whom Ruth Myers and I share a large kennel. And we got him from the pound. He's a Sydney Silky Terrier. And he's quite a... It's worth sharing this with you because, even with those who aren't dog lovers, because we learnt a great deal about Max's owner from observing Max. Isn't that interesting? We didn't know anything about him, but we discovered that his owner had red slippers. I know that because when I put my red slippers on, he went absolutely berserk. We know that his owner had a car and that he spent a lot of time in the car because he immediately hopped into the car and was happy as Larry. We know that he had a basket that he just fitted into. We got him one for Christmas, and before we had it on the ground, here he was with his paws in the basket trying to get in. Interesting, isn't it? How much people can tell about our owners from the way we behave. Worth taking on board. All right. What I want to talk about this morning is the effect of grief on relationships and how to help people in grief. Not my ideas, but what we learn from what is in the book of Job. It's a funny thing that when the pressure's really on, when people are in grief, in terms of their relationships, one of two things happens. The team closes ranks, and the person who is in grief is tremendously encouraged by the help and support of that team. But the other thing that sometimes happens is that the people whom you expect to be there for you somehow aren't. I worked for a number of years on a project in quality of life in cancer patients, and this was one thing that they would say. It's a funny thing, you know, I thought that person was my friend, I thought they'd really be there for me, but they didn't seem to be able to cope with the way that I am. But on the other hand, they said, there were people who came out of the woodwork that I never expected would be there for me. And one of the things that we can get from reading this book is a few clues about how to be in the latter group rather than in the group that can't cope and therefore is not there for the person. I just want to talk a little bit about stress and coping. Just excuse me for a moment because it does have some bearing on what's going to follow. Now, I did that after we went to a course on how to do transparencies. Okay. A stressor is the hard thing that comes into your life. A stressor comes over the horizon and goes through my personal filter. I process this. I say to myself, what does this mean to me? And then, what resources do I have? Can I cope with this? And depending on the answers to those questions, out the other end comes stress. Or no stress. Or triumphing gloriously, depending on who we are. I've just listed there some of the things that influence the way you and I process the things that happen to us. I might get them out of order. Our personality, our temperament, very important. I mean, some of us are ping pong balls and we get uptight a bit more easily than others, but we don't have to be dismayed by that because we're the creative people in the world, folks. We're the ones who produce beautiful music. Not that I'm saying you get uptight easily. Please don't think that. And write poems and all these kinds of things. We're one of God's great gifts to mankind. So don't let's get dismayed if we're ping pong balls. family background. They say our parents and our grandparents are alive and well in us. Agree? So family background, generations. I wish we had time to talk about the effect of generations on people's outlook. Of course, you all know it. You know how different your children are from you, how different you are from your parents. It's been said that one of the most important determinants of the way we look at life is the year in which we were born. Interesting. Absolutely fascinating. I did bring with me a little booklet which you might be interested in. It was a lecture I gave at the Bible College of Victoria, and there's a lot in that about generations if you want to read more about it. Okay. And so on. Gender, of course, makes a little bit of difference to the way we look at things, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, we only have Max. We don't know. Culture. Age. Of course, as you get older, you become more mature and able to cope better with things, don't you? Yes. Right. And health. We know that health makes a lot of difference to our capacity to cope with things or not cope with things. And our past experience may cause us to say, oh, well, we've coped with this before, we'll manage again. Or it might cause us to say, oh, no, we fell in a heap last time, what's going to happen to us this time? All these kinds of things make a difference. Last one. In case the people at the back didn't see it, beliefs and values. And I mean, nothing is more important than the whole philosophy that we have of life. Into what habitual way of looking at life do we receive the hard things that happen to us? One of the things that I do, as I was telling you last night, is that I often drive along the Newcastle Freeway. And I often do it at night, driving home at night. And sometimes when I've gone a certain distance, I say to myself, I wonder where we are. Ever done that? And you look around, you identify a landmark or two, and you say, oh, the car's going in the right direction. Isn't that great? It's so used to going in that direction, it goes that way without me thinking about it. And that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about treasuring the word of the Lord, as Job put it, storing up scripture when things are going well, so that when the hard things happen, we habitually keep going in that direction. And of course, that's what the kind of person that Job was. We've heard about his intimate relationship with God, so that when the hard things came, Job was able to say, God gave us all those blessings. God's taken them away. That's okay. He's God. He's in charge of our lives. We're not going to lie on the ground and kick and scream because he's taken away the things that he freely gave us. May the Lord of the name of the Lord be praised. Okay, the other thing I want to say that doesn't have a direct bearing on Job, but it will later on, is the effects of pressure add up. Now, people at the back may not necessarily see this. I sat at the back last time and I didn't see everything. But suppose this represents my coping capacity. When some of us would have a much bigger coping capacity than that, they might have a great big thing like a beer mug. If any of you have ever seen a beer mug, I don't suppose you have. Big thing. And some of us are like this, okay? So that's my coping capacity. And when I wake up in the morning, that's the amount that I can cope with, okay? I felt a little bit like, yes, I would like a bit of help, thank you. You know the one, and some mothers do have him. So okay. Michael Palin. Righto. So, I wake up and I remember the things that I'm facing today. Okay? So immediately some of my coping capacity is taken up. And so we go on. As the day goes on, the effects of pressures adds up. Did you know that? Yes, well, the scientists have proved it now. Okay, so here I am at the end of the day, and I look just the same as usual. Nobody suspects there's anything wrong with me. And then somebody says something quite harmless, and suddenly everything goes everywhere, okay? Everything's going everywhere, folks, at the back. That's called stress overload, okay? Now, the reason I mention that, thank you very much. The reason I mention that is that you and I find, do we not, that when everything is going everywhere for me and everything happens to be going everywhere for you, it's hard for us to relate in a normal way. You agree? In fact, Ruth and I, Ruth Myers I'm talking about now, Ruth and I find that if we've got some kind of important meeting that we're preparing for and we're both a little bit uptight to the point of verging on the brink of overload, that's the time when we may not necessarily get on as well as usual. And if we don't watch out, we'll find ourselves in some kind of minor dispute. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. It's very important at that time then to be able to say, wait, just a moment. This person that I'm being rude to is the one of whom God says there's no one like her in all the world. This is my friend Ruth, whom I love and whom God loves. And just to be able to pause and say, yeah, this is the one whom God loves, takes the edge off that minor dispute. Okay. Mark Twain is alleged to have said, a fish with a hook in his mouth behaves differently from a fish without a hook in his mouth. And we need to recognise that about one another. Okay. So we're going to talk about Job's wife, and you might see the connection between some of these things that I've been saying and Job's wife. Oh, it's getting hot, isn't it? Have you noticed that? Who was it doing the menopause talk? Open the windows. Okay. Oh, it's all right, it's all right. Only joking. Only joking. Oh, you were feeling hot too. Okay. Job's wife. Now, I just want to read two verses from chapter 2. Job was sitting on the ground with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head in absolute misery, and his wife, who was a very quiet lady, because this is the only thing that we heard her say in the whole 42 chapters. Job's wife says, are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die. Remember, this is the very thing that Satan said would happen. Job would say, curse God. And now his wife is saying, curse God and die. So his wife is on Satan's side for the moment. He, that is Job, replied, you are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. What did we say folly was last night? Can anyone remember? No one could remember. Beg pardon? Good girl. Sorry for blocking your computers last night. I went away with a sense I blocked their computers. I'm really sorry. I have a terrible tendency, Ruth tells me, to block people's computers. So I'll try not to do it. But if I'm blocking anyone's computers, put your hand up. I don't mind at all. going through something again if you don't understand what I'm talking about. Okay. Folly in the book of Job is ignorance of God. Folly in the book of Job is ignorance of God. Wisdom equals knowledge of God. Okay? Job said to his wife, "You are talking like a foolish woman." To be interpreted, "You are talking like a woman who doesn't know God." You're talking about a woman who doesn't know anything about God. And he might have said, "Don't you remember how God blessed us? Don't you remember all he gave us? Don't you remember how you and I think, how you and I together enjoyed this intimate relationship with God? You're talking like a foolish woman." He didn't say, "You are a foolish woman." He said, "You're talking like a foolish woman." That says to me, that wasn't the way she normally behaved. Job's wife was like a fish with a hook in the mouth. We ask ourselves, why? Well, do we have to ask ourselves why? Job's wife had lost 10 children. You know, we hear all about Job losing 10 children. What about his wife? What about all the other things that she had lost along with Job? And now she has to sit beside him and see him going through this terrible illness. Will you and I be surprised to learn that Job's wife was in stress overload, that everything was going everywhere? We would be very surprised to learn that she wasn't, don't you think? So, I regard Job's wife as being a very maligned woman. Sure, she was suggesting to Job that he do the very thing that Satan had suggested. But she was talking out of her pain. She was talking out of her stress overload condition. And it's great that instead of them having a conflict, which would have happened if I'd been in that situation, I'm certain, Job is really quite nice to her. I mean, well, quite nice. Said, "You're talking like someone who doesn't know anything about God. Pull yourself together, woman." I don't suppose it was a really terribly nice thing to say. It was a bit provocative. But anyway, she didn't say anything. It's greatly to her credit that she said nothing. Or if she did, it wasn't recorded. Perhaps what she said couldn't be recorded. We don't know. But anyway, we're focusing on Job. In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. And I was thinking last night, whereas when Eve said to Adam, "Look, it's okay, eat the fruit, what God said wasn't true, then Adam went ahead and ate it. But Job didn't. And that's a very important thing to get out of this, that she said, "Look, things are just so dreadful, why don't you curse God and die?" And he said, "Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" So, I've got here, beware of big blow-ups when both under pressure. Beware of big blow-ups when both under pressure. I don't need to say that to you, I guess. But sometimes it's good to remember we're much more vulnerable to big blow-ups when we're under pressure. We're much more vulnerable to big blow-ups when we're together going through some terrible loss and grief. I mean, this is why people who've lost a child may then go through a marriage breakdown. And it's very important then to realise that the book of Job tells us this is not the end of the story. We go to chapter 42 to see the end of this particular story. It's a great end. So even when we're talking about relationships, we can say trouble, tunnel. Thank you. Treasure. Okay. Trust. Treasure. All right, so we read what happened after everything got all right again. I mean, I'm assuming that Job didn't marry someone else. I mean, if he does, my whole argument breaks down. Doesn't say he married someone else. This poor girl who'd already had 10 children then has another 10. Anyway, She did. They got back together again, I presume, and they had 10 more children. And look at verse 15. No, 14. No, 13. It's interesting to note that the livestock that they had, verse 12, were all twice as much as before, but I can understand that the children wouldn't be twice as many. I mean, 20's a bit many. All right. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. The first daughter he named Jemima. Anyone here called Jemima? No. Okay. The second, Keziah. Any Keziahs here? No. All right. And the third, Keren Happuch. Stand up, Keren Happuch. Nowhere in all the land were there found women as beautiful as Job's daughters. Nowhere in all the land were there found women as beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father granted them an inheritance along with their brothers. Great, eh? So it all ended very well, and it ended very well because they hung in together, we presume. While they were in the dark tunnel, they didn't decide to separate while they were in the dark tunnel. Dark tunnels are not the times to make decisions of that kind. That's why people who've been bereaved really oughtn't to move to another district within 6 or 12 months of being bereaved, because it's too much for them. I mean, the good things add pressure as much as the bad things. So we shouldn't make important decisions while we're in dark tunnels. We say to missionaries, don't put in your resignation when you're going through the business of coping with furlough. You see, you might think, oh, a missionary really looks forward to furlough and thinks furloughs are terrific. But furloughs can be a bit dark tunnelish sometimes. Don't put in your resignation then. Wait until everything's back to normal again. And then look at the thing squarely. Okay. So, there was no marriage breakup for Job and Mrs. Job, we think. And there was a wonderful outcome. Now the friends. We're talking about the effect of grief on people's support network. Job's 3 friends. And I'll just read these few verses. There aren't many there. Chapter 2, verses 11. Wait, Viv, until you come to the time where you can't read through your bifocals. Now, that's something. When Job's 3 friends, Eliphaz or Eliphaz, depending on where you come from, the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar, the Naamathite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, Job, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathise with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognise him. They began to weep aloud, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. Now, I've heard people preach sermons on this passage and say, these friends are absolutely hopeless. I mean, they sat beside him for 7 days and they didn't say anything. I think that's great that they didn't say anything for 7 days. But we'll come back to that in a minute. What I want us to realise is that in these 3 friends, Job had 3 special people. It's said that if you've got 5 people whose eyes light up when they see you, you're okay. We'll have a little spell while we all do our little counting up. Anyway, we know that Job had 3 friends whose eyes lit up when they saw him. How do we know that? Well, as soon as they heard, they came. Imagine coming to someone who'd gone through all that. Imagine what you'd be thinking on route. What on earth am I going to do when I get there? What on earth am I going to say? Nonetheless, they came. And Eliphaz at least came from Arabia. We're not too sure where the others came from, but they came a long way. They left their homes, they left whatever they were doing, and they came. They came with the idea of sympathising with him and comforting him. And we know that they did feel his pain. Sympathy means feeling pain together. They did feel his pain because as soon as they saw him, they cried. They could hardly recognise him. And I noticed when I was preparing this, something I hadn't noticed before, the words, when they saw him from a distance. You know how it is with some people, they don't even seem to see you when you're right beside them. You know people like that? Well, they're the people who don't love you. The ones who love you see you from a distance. They perceive your needs even when you're trying to keep them to yourself. I think I'm behaving perfectly normally, and Ruth will say, what's the matter? I say, what do you mean, what's the matter? There's nothing the matter. Of course there's nothing the matter. The people close to us know the little signs. They can see from a distance when there's something wrong. These friends saw from a distance, and what they saw, they could hardly recognise. So they came and they sat with him where he was. I think that's very important. What people in grief do not want is people who are going to take a superior position, people who are going to come as helpers. I'm the helper and you're the helpee. That's clear, and I'm not going to let you see anything about me. I'm going to keep my layer in place. You're the one who's going to be helped. Okay, we'll focus on you. That's not what people in grief want. And they came and they were prepared to sit where he was on the ash heap for 7 days and nights. Now we might read that and think, oh yeah, 7 days and nights. Well, as a resident at St George Hospital in Cogra many years ago, this was in the bad old days when they didn't have shifts for doctors, I would sometimes come on duty on Friday morning and go off duty on Monday night. And if I got a little bit of sleep here and there in the weekend, I thought I was doing very well. But these people sat beside their friend for 7 days and 7 nights and cried with him. And, I mean, that is something. How could we say they didn't love him? Of course they loved him. You couldn't do that if you didn't love a person. And they said nothing. Why did they say nothing? Because they saw how great his suffering was. There weren't any words. How's everyone going? How are your computers going? You okay? And the other thing that... Oh, no, I was going to say a little bit about communication, about them saying nothing. It's very interesting that what we say is only about 5% of the message that we convey. I suppose it's different when you're standing up here. I mean, if I didn't say anything, you wouldn't get much of a message. But by and large, in our normal interaction with one another, what we say is only a fragment of what we convey. I mean, I can say to you, I am not angry. And what I say would be totally irrelevant to the communication that you get. So what the communication that Job's friends gave to him was, they came, they sat with him where he was, they cried. And I have no doubt that as a result of those things, Job was comforted. I remember when my eldest nephew, who just finished medicine, was killed in a car accident, a lovely young man. I was in Papua New Guinea, and a telegram came to me, and my friend, Concy White, opened the telegram while I was out of the office, and I came back in, and she handed me the telegram. She couldn't say anything because she was crying. That was quite a few years ago now, but I've never forgotten her tears. So it's okay not to say anything. What can you say to someone who's lost 10 children? All you can do is be there and cry, and that speaks volumes. The other thing that Job's friends did that was different is that they stayed with him. After everyone else had gone home, after the funeral, saying to one another, wasn't she marvellous? Wasn't she marvellous at the funeral? Well, she was marvellous because of the provision of the Lord, what I call divine anaesthesia. That lasts during the funeral, after the funeral, and the doors closed. Then Job chapter 3 happened. Okay? But Job's friends were different. They stayed with him after the door had closed. That says to me they loved Job. They really loved him. So let's remember that as we think about the things that happened afterwards. Job, I think, feeling safe with them, because their eyes did light up when they saw him, normally. And they cried with him. He felt safe to let it all pour out. And what poured out was cursing the day of his birth, never cursing God. Cursing the day of his birth. This is chapter 3. We haven't got time to read it. But take it from me that it's basically Job cursing the day of his birth, longing for death, deploring his life, verse 20, why is light given to those in misery and life to the bitter of soul? And then saying, the thing that I dread most is continuing to live. Ever felt like that? I think it's what Paul meant when he said we had the sentence of death in our hearts. We had the sentence of death in our hearts. But just as in the story of Job, in the story of Paul, that wasn't the end of the story. He said, but that was the time when I discovered, as I'd never known before, that God is the one who raises the dead. In a sense, I had to go through that experience of having the sentence of death in my heart in order to understand God is the one who raises the dead. And that was Job's experience too. God is the one who raises the dead. Okay. So, Job's friends were there for that outburst. And yet, Job says of them later on, chapter 16 and chapter 13, they were miserable comforters. They didn't comfort him. But we have to remember that Job was speaking from his situation of stress overload. He wasn't seeing things particularly straight, and neither were they. He said they're miserable comforters, and the commentator that I was using said the words translated miserable comforters actually means you, far from comforting me, you've actually added to what I have to cope with by the things that you've said. And he called them worthless physicians, and that really strikes home to me. I mean, the worst thing you can say to a physician is to say you're worthless, but that's what Job said. So what went wrong? And I'm suggesting to you that what went wrong was that the friends had reached their limit of coping. They couldn't cope. I mean, they loved Job. And all those things that Job had gone through, they'd taken on board to some extent themselves, as far as anyone beside a person who's going through it could. And then when Job, this person whom they'd always looked up to and respected, the greatest man in all the East, had been a real friend to them. I mean, Job was the person who was always there for people. We read about it in chapter 29 or 30, I forget which. You'll have to look it up. And so will I. Later. But not now. There isn't time. Keep quiet. Let's go on. What was I saying? Yeah. It was suddenly too much for them. And so when Job started pouring it all out, they got panicky. It's easy to get panicky, isn't it? When people in grief are starting to say things like, why is God making me his target? Does it please you, Lord, to spurn me? And things of that kind. God has shattered me and all those things. But the things that Job said in chapter 3 were too much for them. And then we find chapter 4, Eliphaz. Or Eliphaz. And of the three, he was the most gentle and the most pastoral. And he starts off in verse 2. If someone ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? He's trying to come at it gently. Remember, think how you have instructed many, how you have strengthened feeble hands. Your words have supported those who stumbled. You've strengthened faltering knees. So what's gone wrong, Job? Now trouble comes to you, and you're discouraged, the very thing that you told other people not to be. You're doing yourself. It strikes you, and you're dismayed. Shouldn't your piety be your confidence? Shouldn't your piety be your confidence? And your blameless ways, your hope? Pull yourself together, Job. Consider now, who, being innocent, has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed? As I have observed, those who plough evil and those who sow trouble reap it. They were agreed about the problem, I think. The problem was that Job was being punished. They were agreed, the friends and Job, that it was legitimate to ask why. Why was Job being punished? And the conclusion of the friends was, because they knew exactly what God was like. What does that mean? Box. Because they had God in a box. This is what God is like. If you say that God's anything different from that, I won't be able to cope with it because all my religion's going to fall in a heap. This is what my God is like. If you sin, you're punished. It follows, if you're being punished, you must have sinned. So we made a big mistake about you, Job. We had quite the wrong idea about you. All this time, you've been hiding some terrible sin, and you hid it from us. And that's why God's punishing you. And what you need to do is repent, and he'll restore you. Now, I can identify with them. I'm a diagnoser and a prescriber too. Hopeless at counselling people because I keep on diagnosing and telling them what to do. It's taken me years to get even slightly out of the mode. But of course, when people come to you who are ill, they want the diagnosis and they want treatment. But when people come to you in Job's condition, they don't want that. Job said, I know all those things. I know the things you're telling me. I don't need you to tell me them. Actually, or Job may not have said this, but the average person in grief might have added, that's what I'm hitting myself over the head with now. I know all those things. I know I shouldn't be anxious. I know that God's there. But as Job says in his next chapter, the reason I'm talking like this is I'm in pain. Don't you see? I'm in pain. That's why I'm crying out these things. I'm in pain. I don't need your answers. I don't want your pat answers. Chapter 6 gives us a little bit of what Job says to his friends, which is helpful to us in our ministry to others. Verse 14. Underline this. Please underline it if you're an underliner in Bibles. If you're not, then don't, of course. But if you are, please underline it. Job says, after having said to them, you're no help to me. I look to you for help, but you weren't there for me. You're not there for me. In fact, you're making things worse. The most wise thing you could do is to keep quiet. He says that later in their discussion, not in this chapter. Verse 14, a despairing man should have the devotion of his friends. Even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. How about that? Even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. Can I keep on loving you if you're saying God's not there, God's silent? In fact, I even doubt whether God exists. Can I keep loving you under those circumstances? Well, if I can't, I'm a useless friend to you. A friend is one who's for you, come what may, who keeps on loving you even if you say most dreadful things. And of course Job was saying these things because he was in pain. I'm in pain. Can't you see beyond my pain? If you can't see beyond my pain, can you see behind it to the person that you used to think I was? Can you see beyond it to the person that I'm going to be? Can you catch a glimpse of the person I'm going to be and not treat me as if this is the whole story of my life? The way I behave when I'm in my dark tunnel is not the story of my life. Please don't treat me as if it were. So, my brothers, verse 13, are as undependable as intermittent streams. And verse 24, teach me and I will be quiet. Show me where I have been wrong, says Job. You say I'm wrong. How painful are honest words, but what do your arguments prove? Do you mean to correct what I say? I tell you, I am innocent. And treat the words of a despairing man as wind. On more than one occasion, you know what his friend said about Job? You're a windbag. What a great help to someone in grief. You're a windbag. And Job's absolutely craving to be heard, to be accepted, to be encouraged. No pat answers. I don't want your pat answers. Now, I gave the illustration last night of the bushfire. It mightn't have been much of an illustration, but I was thinking about it in this context. When the fire was on and all the firefighters are out there desperately trying to put the fire out, they'd have loved it if somebody had come up beside them and said, you know, gum trees really need fires periodically. And after this is all over, we're going to see marvellous green growth. Nobody would have blamed them if there had been a few deaths in the immediate vicinity. How painful are honest words. I want to be listened to, etc. and so on. And the next one who spoke was Bildad, chapter 8. He made it perfectly clear that they hadn't listened to anything that Job had said. He begins, how long will you say such things? Your words are a blustering wind. Great. And then they go on with the same refrain, God punishes sin, therefore you must be a sinner. Therefore you've been deceiving us all these years. Okay. I better leave out a few. 3 or 4 or 5 pages, I think. Okay, so really what I'm saying is, without us having opportunity to go into detail and pick out individual verses, what we're saying is that basically the friends were unable to be there for Job, even though they dearly loved him, basically because of their own small view of God. That's what was at the heart of it. Their own small view of God, and because they saw that their friend must have done something dreadful, then in a panicky way they try to rescue him and to get him to do something about it. That's what was at the heart of it. Job, on the other hand, knew he was innocent, and he never, ever, ever had God in a box. I guess he would have hardly agreed with Sidlow Baxter, who said of the man of God, all his discoveries about the Lord only made him see how much more there was to be discovered. So Job's pain drove him to God to discover more and more. There must be something more. This is happening. I'm innocent. God is punishing me. There must be a reason. And I am committed to discovering what that reason is. And we'll come back to that in more detail tomorrow. To conclude, part 2. What lessons can we draw from all this about how to be there for friends in trouble? Because we want to be people who can be there for friends in trouble, don't we? Yep, of course we do. When I was first preparing it, I went through a whole list of things. But then it occurred to me that basically... Sorry if I've distracted you with that. I forgot to turn it off. Basically, I'm going to suggest that there are two things that we need to focus on if we're really going to be there for friends in trouble. The first of these is cultivating God's view of people. Cultivating God's view of people. I call it treasure hunting. You know, the whole aim of communication is to discover the treasure that's behind the communication. And it's really fascinating. If you're committed to treasure hunting, this involves you in sitting next to the person that you may not, humanly speaking, particularly like, with the idea of trying to discover who that person is, where they're coming from. Because we know that God looks at you and me and says there's no one like her in all the world. See, we don't have to be like Job for God to say that about you and me. We can say that because Jesus has died and we belong to him. Bishop Handley Mole, or Mool, however you pronounce it, gave this terrific illustration of coming into the presence of the Lord and Jesus taking him into the presence of the Lord and looking at God and saying, "Father, this is Tom. I died for him." And the Lord looking at, God looking at Tom and being 100% satisfied. That's how he is with you and me. Sometimes, I don't know about you, but sometimes I think, what's going to happen when I die and see the Lord? What's going to happen when I think about my life and so on? And then I remember that illustration. Jesus will be there and you'll say, "This is Kath. I died for her." And God will say, that's okay, that's fine. So we can look at chapter 1, verse 8, and maybe it's verse 8 or wherever, somewhere around about there, maybe it's 2 verse 8, but anyway, the same words. No, it's not 2 verse 8. Yes, it's 2 verse 3. I knew it was somewhere around there. And 1 verse something. 1 verse 8, thank you. Okay. "Have you considered my servant Job? Have you considered my servant Kath? Have you considered my servant Ruth, Lynn, Viv, whoever? There's no one like her in all the world." Full stop. "Not he's blameless, she's blameless and upright. My son is blameless and upright." And so when I look at her, I say there is no one like her in the whole world. You might not think very much of yourself. If that's the case, you're really nailing Jesus to the cross again, because that's the very reason why he died, so that God would look at you and say there's no one like her in all the world. Well, if that applies to me, it also applies to this person whom I'm finding a real pain in the neck to get on with. So I've got to be in the business of treasure hunting with regard to other people. And so that's number one. God's view of people is the treasure hunting view, seeing beyond the awful things that might be happening now to what the person has it in them to be. In Romans 15 and 7... when Paul's been talking about our corporate responsibility together to glorify God, he goes on to say, "Accept one another, therefore, just as Christ accepted you." How does Christ accept me? The way he accepted Peter. He said, "Peter, you're going to deny me, but when you have returned, strengthen the brethren." See, he looked beyond Peter's terrible failure to what he was going to do and be. And he does that with us, and we're to do that with one another. And I venture to suggest that unless we are doing that for and with the person who's grieving, we're not going to get very far. If we're going to be sitting beside them, being critical of them for what they're saying, or for the fact that they're taking so long to get over it, you know, we talk to one another and say, she should be over it now. It's 6 months, or it's 1 year, or it's 5 years, or it's 10 years. She should be over it now. She'll never really be over it, because she's vulnerable in a way that she never was before. Ah. But out of that vulnerability is the potential for ministry. That's making our wounds available for the healing of other people. Okay. So we've got to have that treasure hunting view of people. And just one little illustration. When our dog Toby died, some of you might have heard of Toby. He was the dearest little dog in all the world. And anyway, he got cancer and he died. And Ruth and I did all the right things with our grieving. We discussed, you know, the right time to do it. And when we knew we were going to take him down to the vet to be put down, we went out into the garden and we dug a grave for him there, so that when he came back he could go straight into that grave. And when he went into the grave, the non-dog lovers don't listen. We even had a little prayer and thank the Lord for the way he blessed us through Toby. He had. He was marvellous therapy to me when I came back from Papua New Guinea permanently. And I found it, I mean, we cried a lot about Toby. And a friend of ours, seeing us crying, said to us, Christians shouldn't cry about dogs. He's only a dog, you know. And ever since I've had that feeling that person didn't see me the way she'd seen me before. I'd somehow I'd have gone down a few pegs in her estimation. So that's not the treasure hunting view. The treasure hunting view says, well, this person is a bit strange crying about her dog. Nonetheless, that's part of who she is. And I care about who she is, and she's a treasure. After my mum died, I had anxiety neurosis. I was also doing medicine at the time. It was a bit hard. We had to cope with autopsies and things. And one symptom of this neurosis was that I used to sing in the choir, and I always thought I was going to faint when we were in the middle of the anthem. You know, mess the whole show up. Never fainted in my life, but this was the thing I was really frightened of. And there was a lady, an older lady, who stood beside me, and she somehow saw me from a distance, you know, perceived when I was really upset. And she just put a hand on my arm. And I knew that was saying, you'll rise above it, Kath. You'll rise above it. And I did. See, we need people to have that view of us in order to become the people that God always intended us to be from before the foundation of the earth. So there's that. And there are only two, so don't worry. The first, and this is about how we can be there for friends in trouble. One, keep on treasure hunting, however things may seem. Keep on being for that person, come what may. And the second is God's view of God, Job's view of God. Cultivate Job's view of God. What was Job's view of God? That there was always something far, far more to be discovered. I once saw a television thing about astronomy being advertised, and it said, this all blow your mind, this will rewrite the book of Genesis. And some people didn't watch it for that reason. I thought, fancy not watching something about the marvels that God has made because some foolish person, ignorant of God, has said this is going to rewrite the book of Genesis. How could anything that we learn about the marvels of God's creation reduce our conception of God. So those are the things that I think are vital. If those things are in place, then we will be there for the person. We will be prepared to listen. We will be prepared to wait, because we know that this all that's going on now isn't the end of the story. The end of the story is a treasure. This person is a treasure, and we're going to see something great come out of this sooner or later. And if I can be there to facilitate this, well, that's a privilege. And then trusting the person to God, just as God is trusting the person to hang on in faith and to defeat Satan in that area. God's honour is at stake, and he trusts us to keep on trusting him even when the tunnel is totally dark, believing, and this book of Job tells us, believing that one day we're going to come through to the other end, and it's just going to be so marvellous. Derek Kidner says in one of his commentaries, in that day there'll be unquestionable answers to our present unanswerable questions. Many of our questions are never going to get answers in this world. So hang in there, girls, and we're going to arrive at the treasure.